Hello and welcome to the Android Central podcast. My name is Daniel Bader. This week on the show, there is so much to talk about in the realm of folding phones. So we are going to dive into the Z Fold 2, the Surface Duo. We're also going to talk about Samsung's other flagship-ish phone, the Galaxy Note 20. And we'll get into a little bit about the LG Wing, because we've now learned a lot about it. And then in the second half of our show, we're just going to talk video games, because we don't do that enough on this podcast. We're going to go through what happened this week, the crazy leak that led to Microsoft officially announcing the pricing and availability of the Xbox Series S, or revealing the Xbox Series S, talking about the price of the Xbox Series X. We're going to compare that to Stadia. We're also going to talk about the upcoming release of Xbox Game Pass Ultimate, which includes the service formerly known as xCloud. And we'll get into some potentially other interesting news around Doom and Doom 2 on Android, just because I love those games and I love talking about cool Android games. So to join me this week, Hayato Huseman, welcome back. What's going on?
Hello, fellow video host.
Yes, sir. I'm very embarrassed. I'm embarrassed for our YouTube feed, but
you did great.
I spent a lot of the week figuring out how to do a roll, which is very hard, much harder than I ever
thought.
Oh
yeah. Yeah. It's not my favorite.
And then I had to refactor my office entirely to make it into a video studio of sorts. And the behind the scenes take is, or the behind the scenes info is that the take that eventually made it into the video was my 30th take.
Ooh.
And
oh my
I
gosh.
I got it at like 1 a.m. So this was after me basically just screaming for hours because I messed up previous takes, and then just settling because I was like, I'm so tired. I just need to do this. Anyway, also joining us this week after a while, and I'm so happy to have him back, Russell Holly. Welcome back.
Hello.
You're here to keep us in the loop about all the fun things. All your gaming team just has the most fun. I'm so jealous.
It's really funny how sometimes the team just gets really, really stressed about the same kind of stuff that the Android Central team gets stressed out about, like embargoes and meetings and interviews and all this stuff. And then they kind of have to stop and remember that like the hardest part of their job is playing 10 hours of game time in 5 hours so that they can write a review. It's very funny.
Yeah. Yeah. What are you playing right now, just to start things off?
I just started Marvel's The Avengers on my Xbox because it just looks like a ton of fun, and it didn't originally, so I got surprised and decided I would pick it up. And then I'm also playing, they released a DLC for Vacation Simulator on the Oculus Quest, so I get to leave my actual job and then go be a virtual cabana boy at a virtual pool where my robot overlords order things that they don't need from me. And I did that for like 4 hours yesterday, so I'm clearly spending my quarantine time really well.
In Vacation Simulator, you don't play somebody on vacation, you play somebody at work.
So you did originally. Job Simulator was you in like a simulated office, because you're like one of the last remaining humans, and like the robots are trying to keep you alive and stimulated, so they created like a fake office for you to work in, or like a Amazing. Fake convenience store for you to work in. And like that was like the whole gag as they're going through this. And then they you know, the robots decided that every once in a while a human needs to go on vacation. So they created a Vacation Simulator, which is the sequel game where you go and do vacationing things. And that's all like, you know, exploring a beach or like a mountain lodge or something like that. And then they added a DLC that just came out this week called Back to Job, Vacation Simulator Back to Job. And it is you are a temp worker at the resort that you were staying at. And so like the whole game is just like unnecessarily really funny jabs at the gig economy. So like you work for a certain number of hours and they come and give you a thing and they're like, hey, so you've been working here as a freelancer for a really long time. We've decided to hire you. And then he gets a phone call in the process of hiring you that says, oh, actually there was a data breach, and we lost all of your rating stuff. So you have to start over. Cause there was this massive data breach for all of our rating systems.
I just want to know the team of game developers that wants to make a game like that, especially if it was if it started as a gag and then ended up being successful, like Goat Simulator, for instance.
Oh yeah.
Or Untitled Goose Game. Like, I'm guessing those just started out as like jokes in the office that eventually became real games. They're like, wait a second, people might want to play this.
Oh, the story behind Untitled Goose Game is amazing, because it was actually a like nothing indie game that was stuck in the corner of GDC like 4 years ago now, I think. It was 4 years ago. There was a single person running that booth for this like actual gag thing. They were like, yeah, we did this thing and we thought it would be fine. And there were 350 people around that booth by the end of the first day trying to play it. And Lori Gill from iMore and I saw it pretty early in the day, and we sat down and played it for like an hour and a half, but like way before the game had any kind of real like shape or achievements or anything. And it was just ridiculously fun. And I'm so glad that it turned into an actual game, because when we sat down and played it, like the name Untitled Goose Game was like, that was the thing. Like, they didn't have a name for it, but because it got so popular at GDC, everyone knew it as Untitled Goose Game. And so that's how it became the name of the game.
Remember when you could do that and go to events
places?
And crowd around and play
yeah.
games like that?
Remember places? That.
I remember my bed, because I go there a lot. Everything else is about, is pretty hazy at this point. All right, let's wait until the second half of the show to talk more about video games, because I know people are pretty interested in these foldy phones. Hayato, you've had a very busy week, and
I sure have.
It is not it's not for nothing that you've only slept like 4 hours in the last 3 days or something. So I appreciate all the work you've done. Let's start with the Galaxy Fold 2, and I'm just going to call it the Galaxy Fold 2 because the future isn't flat. This is a phone that you and I went back and forth on about giving a 5-star review, and we settled on 4.5 out of 5 because no phone is perfect, et cetera, et cetera. But I do want to talk about how much you like this thing, and also how much better it is than the previous version. You're not alone in this, right? This is, you know, The Verge came out with their review this week as well. I think every other site that I've seen has sort of praised this as being an extravagance, but a successful one. So give us your thoughts on why it's so much better than the first.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest change for me is the fact that the cover screen now takes up the whole front of the phone. So it really changes how you use it versus the short time I spent with the original Fold, where, you know, that cover screen was so small that you could really only use it for notifications and really small things. You didn't really want to use it for anything for more than, you know, 2 minutes or so. The cover screen on the Fold 2, because it's so much bigger, it really feels like just using a normal phone that just happens to be really narrow and tall. And you can do all your normal phone things with regular apps and not just notifications. And so it really makes the Fold feel more like having two devices instead of just like having a tablet that shrinks to a frustratingly small screen. And it makes it a one-handed device when you need it to be. And that's a really big deal to me. I mean, other than that, you know, it's just fixing so many things with the original Fold. The hinge is so much more rigid, and you can use it for all the flex mode things where, you know, certain apps will rearrange themselves when you fold the screen. It's not very widely implemented, but it does work really well for the apps that it has been optimized for. And just the whole thing feels so refined, where last year's Fold felt like this is a really cool experiment, but it's still just an experiment. This is a phone that like actually feels like a complete, fully thought out product that somebody could and should buy right now, assuming they don't mind dropping $2,000 on a cell phone.
And that's interesting. You know, it's something that it always takes that second generation to iron out any bugs. But the ones that really affected the first note were concerns about resilience. The first Fold were concerns about resilience, that the plastic screen was susceptible to scratches, that it wouldn't hold up in inclement weather, that the repeated folding would potentially damage it, or it may not hold up to the regular stresses of daily life. You haven't had it very long, but do you have those concerns with this phone?
Not as much as I did with the first one, but I also don't think this is necessarily going to hold up as well as just a traditional phone that you're not folding in half all the time. You know, they made some improvements, like the ultra thin glass under the sort of outer plastic layer, where the first fold was all plastic. So it should, in theory, be more durable in that regard. Again, the hinge feels more resistant. It's still not waterproof, and that's a big bummer to me. I don't like use my phone in the rain all that often, especially now that I'm not going out of the house when I can avoid it. But it, you know, with a $2,000 phone, you kind of would hope it's going to be waterproof like every other phone on the market these days. So little things like that, I think, add up to a phone that you maybe can't be fully confident in for the entirety of, like, especially if you're financing this for 48 months, like they offer on Samsung's website. Don't finance a phone for 4 years. That's ridiculous. But I don't know that it's going to hold up over the course of 4 years or even 2 years. I trust it more than I trust the first fold, though. And I think that hopefully the next generation will be water resistant. If not, I mean, everything else seems to be pretty airtight. I don't have any like crease aberrations that happened pretty quickly with the original fold. I've only had this for about 10, 11 days, but it's still like a perfectly straight line down the middle.
There's always the question of like, what's the point of a folding phone? I guess some of the questions have been aimed at the Z Flip line or the new Motorola Razr 5G, where they kind of, they're small clamshells that essentially open up into regular size phones. A lot of people like the fact that they don't take up as much space when they're closed. But I wonder, is that an issue when you're trying to figure out how to use this phone and take advantage of it, especially now that the front screen is, you know, it's thin, but it's basically the size of a regular smartphone? How do you decide whether you're going to do something on your on the front one, put it back in your pocket quickly? Do you use it like as a larger smartwatch, sort of as like triage, or are you not using it very much and instead opening up the main screen and using that most of the time? Like, how does that break down for you?
So I use the cover screen a lot more than I expected to, just again, because it's sort of sized like a normal phone. It is still like, because it's so narrow, I don't like typing on it at all. Especially I've been sticking with Samsung's keyboard for the first time because it can split down the middle when you've got the phone extended. And that's kind of nice for ergonomics, but the keyboard itself is a nightmare. So I don't really love typing on the cover screen, but I do use it a lot more than I thought I would. Most of the time, I just kind of decide, like, do I want to use the phone one-handed or can I sit down and actually use it with both hands right now? But the biggest, I guess, most obvious reason to use the main screen is for multitasking. It's so nice to have your apps split down the middle because, you know, you're basically working with two full-sized phone screens right next to each other. So you can have two full-sized apps. And you can run three apps if you want, or three apps and a couple of floating windows. You can do all kinds of stuff. I think it's really most usable with just two apps running at split screen. But there's all sorts of things you can do there. I mean, I've got the podcast rundown for this show pulled up right now, just because it's such a, you know, spreadsheets are so nice on a giant screen, and this is kind of perfect for that sort of thing. So, I mean, spreadsheets aren't sexy, but if you use a lot of spreadsheets, that's a really good use case for something like the Fold.
Hey, my spreadsheets are extremely sexy. I will defend them to,
you know, you've got three colors going on here. It looks pretty good.
They are very attractive spreadsheets. Just that is something I take pride in. I even use, like, actually I'm looking at it right now. My border sizes, the thickness of the borders are not consistent in a couple places. I have to fix that. But I'm a very avid defender of, like, attractive spreadsheets make spreadsheets less shitty. And I'm, you know, like, as somebody who spends a lot of time in spreadsheets, it just means that I don't hate my life whenever I'm using them. So you might as well take the extra time to, I know somebody, we have a coworker at TechRadar. I'm gonna not, maybe I shouldn't name him. But okay, I'm just going to say it. It's Matt Swider. He loves spreadsheets. He loves taking time to build really like just insanely complex spreadsheets. He uses emojis everywhere. And it can be overwhelming. But when you learn his system, it's just, it's a remarkable feat of engineering. I just have to shout him out on that. So he made me love spreadsheets.
He's a good spreadsheet guru, and very few people here will know this, but also PC Mag's Sasha Sagan is also a giant spreadsheet junkie and has gone through just extreme depths to program like 100-page spreadsheets to all be highly functional.
Oh, I totally believe it.
Yeah, it's like that does not surprise me in the least. Oh man, I miss my friends. I miss seeing people in person. This is hitting me in the nostalgia.
I feel like it's a really funny point that you bring up there, Daniel, as far as like wondering what it is people are going to do with the Fold 2. And the reason that I say that is that it's funny is because I feel like a whole bunch of people in the tech world were asking that exact question 2 weeks ago about the last batch of Samsung phones. You know, we were talking about the Note 20 and the Note 20 Ultra. Aside from using the pen, I saw this all over social media. Like, you know, Mr. Mobile was asking, and I saw a bunch of other people, you know, asking what people actually did with these phones. And I think that's actually a really funny thing to think about, that Samsung is currently the only company that we ask that question about. The combination of form factor and features that get added to these phones, nobody asks, what are you going to do with that iPhone? Nobody asks, what are you going to do with that Pixel? It's really fascinating to me that Samsung now has multiple phones out that causes people to kind of stop and go, okay, but like, what do you do with that?
I guess because we've established that there are a set of behaviors that over the last decade or so people do on their phones, right? You have that single piece of glass. The OSs are all made for, you have one screen active, you have some overlays, right? You have your notification shade that can overlay at any time. You can put video in some cases on top of your content, but by and large, you're doing one thing at a time. And we are now at the point where companies are telling us that your phone should be more like how you treat a computer. And I, you know, getting into the what is a computer debate is not really what I want right now, because everybody has that different opinion. But the question is, you know, on an 8-inch screen, should you really be in the business of trying to multitask, actually multitask, or flip it around, when you do engage in that kind of multitasking, is that productive? Or is it better for you to do one thing on your phone and then move to a laptop that is better suited for it? And everybody's got their own opinion. I mean, we can talk about the Surface Duo, which is exactly that. It's literally two screens that forces you into that habit. And right now, I'm just not sure that it's a better experience than just triaging on your phone and then moving that same screen to your computer.
I will say one of the things that that I have enjoyed the most with the Z Fold 2 is apartment hunting. It's fantastic for, because I can have my, you know, all the apartment listings on half of the screen, and on the other half I can have Google Maps pulled up with, you know, looking at that surrounding area, or I can have there's a website called Localize that kind of uses algorithmic data to determine what your, you know, what your living situation should be like within a given address. It's really nice to have those two things kind of pulled up right next to each other. And that's something that, like, you don't have to be, I think a lot of people try to think of things like the Fold as far as, like, you know, how can I use this for work? And that's all that multitasking can be for, is just work. But it's really useful for a lot of personal things like that.
Absolutely. I mean, I think we don't even realize how much work we do on our phones these days. So I think it's about building up those habits and integrating them into your life in a way that makes sense. It isn't just adding unnecessary complexity. That's my concern here, is that by giving you more space without the proper tools to take advantage of them, you're actually just adding unnecessary complexity to your to your workflow, whatever that may be. Like having Slack open on the left side of your Fold 2 sounds like a good idea because you can also have Chrome and also have YouTube or, you know, Spotify open. But inevitably, you're going to get distracted in Twitter, and then you're just going to be scrolling through Twitter on this square on the top right of your screen for 10 minutes, not realizing it. Whereas if you had a regular phone where you just intentionally switched to Twitter and then switched back to Slack, you know, it sounds like a nothing difference, but it does have a significant impact on how you interact with your phone, which is something that you do hundreds of times a day.
I'm just going to say that 10 minutes before we started the podcast, I had Slack pulled up on half of the screen of my Fold, and I was watching your Surface Duo review on the other half. So,
okay, well, then you're fine. That you get a pass. As long as you're watching me on YouTube, then you're all good. So I want to talk, you know, the Fold 2 is this indulgence. It's exceptionally expensive at $2,000, but it feels like it's worth it somehow. A lot of people say that, at least. I haven't used it yet. I'm sure it's better than the first one, but it does feel much more coherent as a piece of design and cohesive as a product that you're selling, a very expensive product that you're selling people. Then there's the Surface Duo, which I reviewed. I've spent 2 weeks with it. You can go read it, watch the video, but I'll TLDR it by saying that there's a lot of good ideas here, and having two screens separate makes a very big difference in terms of how you multitask, because it's just two separate Android apps running at the same time. And while you can span one app across both screens, most of them don't work that well. But the ones that do work well are really what I find to be most impressive. So Microsoft has optimized all of its apps to span properly. So you have like Outlook Mobile, where you have your emails on one side, and then you have your the actual email content on the right side of the screen, very much like a tablet. But then you can just flip one side of the screen around and you have just a regular sized, albeit a very wide phone. Russell, you have, like everybody else on the internet, been inundated now with these Surface Duo reviews. What was your take from the various reactions?
It really just felt like not nearly enough was done to make the software feel coherent. Like, even the early version of the Fold, there was a ton of work done to make it feel like Samsung had an idea of where they wanted things to go. And having watched a bunch of videos now and seen a bunch of the reviews, I feel like Microsoft got halfway there and then kind of had a conversation with Google, and Google was like, yeah, you don't want to do it that way. You want to do it this other way. And so they kind of had to backpedal a little bit to make some of this work. I find it deeply... it's a little concerning that Microsoft went and optimized all of their apps for this experience and keeps talking about how important it is to have these multiple workflows and do all these things, and then didn't make sure that there was a really nice photo editor, like a really, really nice photo editor that spanned both of these screens. And I get it. The camera on this thing is a dumpster. Like, all of the reviews say the same thing, the camera's a dumpster. But I don't know a single person who edits photos who wouldn't want, like, Adobe Photo Cloud on something like this, where they could use like Adobe Photoshop Mobile while they're on the go and like tweak a photo that they had already taken somewhere else, like on two big screens like this. It seems like something like Photoshop Mobile or Lightroom or something like that, like spread across these two screens, would be awesome to use. And Microsoft already has a great partnership with Photoshop. It really seemed like I was expecting that to be kind of one of the launch things to come from this. And it's just really odd that there's just nothing to follow that up.
It's so funny you mentioned Photoshop, because Lightroom, that's the one app that I would have, it would have been a killer app for me, right?
Right.
This would have been the halo of the Microsoft 365, you know, themed Microsoft phone. Like, it felt like there needed to be a killer app. And the only apps that really are killer are the ones that Microsoft built. And they're not that sexy, but I find that an image, there is something called Mylio, which is a video editor that has been optimized for both screens, and it is good. It's a very complicated app, especially on a phone. Like, it still, even in its optimized state, doesn't scale super well on smaller displays. You can tell this was designed for Android tablets in mind, but it's a great showcase of the Duo's potential. But yeah, having a photo on the right side and all the controls explicitly on the left and being able to manipulate them would have been incredible. And I also think that Lightroom Mobile is one of the best editing apps I've ever used on Android. Like, it just, it's so well done that I wonder if Microsoft is in conversation with Adobe, because we all know how late Adobe was to optimize Photoshop and Lightroom for the iPad. But once they were updated, they were incredible.
Yeah, I think that would be really cool to see.
There are a couple of really good use cases, and I did call them out in my review. So Amazon Kindle, like, I know this is a $1,400 phone and that you shouldn't have to use a $1,400 phone for an e-reader, but the e-reading experience on this is so good. And the fact that Amazon updated the Kindle app to support these two screens and their beautiful animations, and it just works so well, it makes me happy just to know that this is there. It's great to be able to, like, flip it into tent mode or laptop mode and play a game on the top screen, and just, like, bring out my, I've been using the Razer Thundercat controller just on its own, sort of like Nintendo Switch style. Mm-hmm. And they work great, and it's super fun. And there are just a bunch of other use cases, but by and large, Microsoft did not spend enough time making sure the software was ready to go.
You just reminded me real quick, actually. You just mentioned tent mode, and I realized that in none of the reviews that I read that mentions that when something is in tent mode, is the other screen actually off?
Russell, it's off. You can't do anything else with it. You can't mirror. It's such a wasted potential. Like, the tent mode and the laptop mode are two of the most frustrating form factors with this phone, because you can't do anything with them. You can't do anything interesting. You can't put game controllers on the bottom. You can't put, like, the keyboard mode on the laptop is, when you're in laptop mode, the keyboard on the bottom is terrible because the touch response on this thing is bad. You can't mirror in tent mode. Like, it just feels incomplete. But yeah, there's a lot of work to do. And I'm looking at this protocol article that David Pierce wrote. You know, Microsoft probably knew that it was going to get hammered in the reviews, so it did a bunch of PR that went live the day before. And this one goes over the introduction that Panos Panay had with Hiroshi Lockheimer at Google to sort of sanity check this project. And basically, Panos Panay said, if we can't get Google on board, we're not making the Duo. Like, we're not just going to make a half-assed version of a phone that can run Android apps but doesn't have GMS. We actually need to go all the way in. And Lockheimer was pretty quickly in, but there were concerns about optimizing Android for this. And what I will say is that Microsoft is, they're submitting a bunch of updates to Android 11 that when they roll out to other hinged phones, they will be, that everybody will benefit. So I'm thinking Samsung will benefit, you know, Huawei will benefit, whatever, because it's all going to be in AOSP. But I'm concerned that Microsoft rushed this and launched it with Android 10 when it would have been to its great benefit to wait until Android 11 later this year and then roll out a much more cohesive experience that consumers would like. This just feels like a beta.
Look, so I do think, though, it's neat that I think it's neat that the Surface Duo has these sort of different, like, methods for, or I guess use cases for different positions of the hinge. That's something I would like to see happen on something like the Fold. But I mean, it's you know, with the Fold, you've got flex mode where it just changes to a different UI basically as soon as you fold the screen. It happens. It's an on off thing. I like that the Duo has sort of different use cases based on how far you've folded the hinge down. I think that's a really neat trick.
I think by making an explicit flex mode, you're obviously limiting what can be done, but you're also explicitly creating experiences for people. So you're not saying, here's a 360-degree hinge, go wild, try to figure out what makes sense for you. Samsung is being like, we're adding flex mode to these 10 apps, and more are coming later. And that feels very much like the right move, because then people can get used to seeing a viewfinder on the bottom of their screen when they're in flex mode, right? It's these kinds of things. But they don't have any third-party support yet, right?
Not much, no. There's There's been a couple of apps, mostly from Samsung and Google. So I guess not really, but I just like, what do you think it's going to take to make that happen, to make developers sort of work around it? Because it's hard to imagine, you know, having any incentive as a developer to make your app work for something like Flex Mode for all of two very expensive phones out in the world.
I mean, I think that's what it comes down to, not having the two of the most expensive phones in the world be the only ones that support it.
Yeah.
I think eventually Samsung's fold, like last year's foldable phones, will still be sold and they'll be considerably discounted. So Samsung obviously can't still sell the first fold because it's just so much worse than the second one. But next year when the Fold 3 comes out, I'm guessing the Fold 2 will go down in price a lot. There's obviously sales on Samsung phones all the time. But once a Fold class phone goes under $1,000, then you can take for granted developers are going to care more. But yeah, I don't know. I think there need to be standard foldable APIs in Android, and that's only going to come with Android 11. So we'll have to wait until that happens. And who knows how long it'll take for Samsung to update the Folds to Android 11.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about the Galaxy Note 20 that you reviewed, Hayato, because this kind of was completely under the radar. It still hasn't really made a splash, but you like this phone a lot better than I think you even expected. So tell us about why you liked it so much.
I did, yeah. I mean, I think the last podcast episode, or maybe the one before that, I kind of dogged on it before I got it, and I just said it really did not look great. But once it came in, it was actually a lot better than I expected. The hardware, like, yeah, the back of it is plastic. I wish it were glass, especially for $1,000, but the plastic feels fine. It's like, it's a matte, soft touch kind of texture. And the rest of the phone acts basically the same as the Note 20 Ultra, with the exception of its completely flat screen, which I actually much prefer versus the curved screen on the Ultra, because on the Ultra, I kept on running into accidental touches. A lot worse than even other curved screen phones I've used, even from Samsung. So I don't know if that was just something off with my Ultra, but I've seen a lot of other people say that they've also run into issues on their units. So who knows? The regular Note 20 doesn't have any of that because of the flat screen. I think it was a huge usability improvement. Really, the only major downside is, I guess unless you count 60 hertz as a huge downside, it's a bummer, but it's not that big a deal. The bigger downside is the cameras are definitely not as good as on the Note 20 Ultra. They're still pretty good, but it sort of feels like, yeah, this is a slight improvement versus the Note 10, where the Note 20 Ultra was like this massive leap from the Note 10 Plus. And you know, you're not getting any kind of crazy zoom on the Note 20. It's I think it was 5x, right? Or 2x, actually, that leaps up to 30? 3x that leaps up to 30.
3x, but it's not an actual distance lens. Like, it's right. Cropping a 64 megapixel sensor, same thing as the S20 Plus. This is basically the S20 Plus's camera system, I think.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the metadata in the telephoto images, it's like my computer tells me that it's 5 millimeters on the regular wide angle camera, but then telephoto is only 6 millimeters. Like, it's a very minor difference.
Yeah, exactly. So you're getting a 12 megapixel photo. I just did the the megapixel 12 megapixel photo cropped from a 64 megapixel sensor. So the focal length is only slightly more than the main one, but you're cropping in and you're not losing much detail. It's a hack, but it's a hack that kind of works, I think. And if you know anything about physics, you know that, you know, you're always negotiating spatial resolution for crop factor. And it's just, you know, you lose one with the other, and you have to, you can do that with your phone right now, even if it has no actual optical, you know, even if the focal length isn't any longer than a regular phone sensor or phone lens, but you're just going to lose a ton of detail. And famously, Google has found a way to figure that out with its super high res zoom. But even that doesn't really match a true optical lens. So, yeah, I don't know. I have a Note 20. I haven't used it much because I been reviewing other things, but it is just so much easier to use. Like, so much nicer to use this phone over the Note 20 Ultra, unless the Note 20 Ultra is in a case, because that sort of fixes some of the false touches.
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, I've got my Ultra in a one of Samsung's leather cases, and it looks and feels great, but I do still run into the occasional accidental touch.
Last thing on the Note 20, do you think that the camera is better than what you get on the OnePlus 8 Pro? Like, I don't think you've used the 8 Pro. You've used the 8, right?
Yeah, I have an 8 Pro now, but I've not had any time to really switch to it and use it just because of everything that's happened in the last month. But versus the OnePlus 8, absolutely. I mean, the 8's cameras were fine. They're better than older OnePlus phones, but they're still not like they're not flagship tier, I wouldn't say. Mm-hmm. The Note 20, I mean, I was very happy with the photos, and actually I would say the Z Fold 2's cameras are very comparable to the regular Note 20's cameras. Both of them take very good photos that like they have all the signature Samsung looks with the really aggressive HDR and the super vibrant colors and high contrast. But if you like that sort of look, I mean, there's really not much to complain about with the regular Note 20, other than you're just not going to get that kind of depth that you'll get on the Note 20 Ultra's enormous main sensor. But otherwise, you know, the cameras are actually very good, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. It's just interesting that the Note 20 is still $100 more than the OnePlus 8 Pro, which is currently what we've crowned as the best phone for most people, given that it's just a good compromise between everything that we like in a flagship. But I think you should do a camera comparison between the OnePlus 8 Pro, the Note 20, and the Note 20 Ultra, and then get back to us and tell us what you like best.
Maybe we can do that on the next podcast.
Yeet. All right, let's talk about something that we can now talk about because we're actually holding this review or this podcast until Monday morning after the embargo lifts. So let's talk about the LG Wing. We can tell you now that this is official. It's coming later this month. It is running a Snapdragon 765. It has 8 gigs of RAM. It's got a really, really interesting camera setup. And what's neat about it is that in camera mode, when the screen is flipped up, it basically runs a software gimbal system where you hold the bottom part like you would a selfie stick or any sort of, you know, Osmo gimbal. And it has a bunch of sensors inside a dedicated 12 megapixel sensor. So there's a 12 megapixel ultra wide camera with additional sensors that detect movement and will adjust accordingly. And the sensor itself is of much higher quality than a typical ultra-wide sensor. It's 1 over 2.55 inches. So LG, at least, is saying that you're going to get flagship-level quality when you're using this in gimbal mode. It has dedicated modes for, like, you know, doing those cool shots where you follow somebody walking or you like, quickly pivot around somebody and it stays stable. It can do like a 180 degree flip really easily. So you go from upright to upside down in one smooth motion. So they're really leaning into this like vlogging life capture thing. And otherwise, it's basically the LG Velvet. So Hayato, what do you think? Is this something people should be interested in?
I don't know. I mean, I think the gimbal system is super interesting, actually, and I would love to sort of see some of the samples from that. And I guess I'll have to wait and see when one of us has one. But I'm still just trying to figure out exactly what the Wing's form factor is really for, and I guess who it's for. I think the gimbal system is a really clever way to make use of all of this, but we kind of talked before we started recording the podcast about, like, you know, is this considered a foldable? Do we think of the Wing as a foldable, or is it just a strange dual screen device that's not quite like LG's other devices? It's not quite like the Surface Duo. It's a really interesting form factor that, like, I just don't know what the use case is.
I think, I mean, we know for sure that LG is going to lean into some like phrase, like a flippable or something, or, you know, just something stupid that they're going to try to get people to adopt, and we're just going to say no. But what's interesting is that LG's saying there's this, you know, 6.8-inch display that can flip up into landscape, and then underneath it, there's that secondary display. It's only 3.9 inches. I think it's a 1-to-1 aspect ratio, so it's basically a square. And you can run any app on that. And we asked them in a briefing, like, should we be concerned about apps not formatting properly on the secondary display? And they're like, well, it's Android, right? Some apps will work really well, others won't. But by and large, all of our experiences, the ones that we've optimized it for, will work great. And what's
what LG's endorsement.
And what LG's, you know, for its massive problems with software, which I don't think are going to be alleviated here, they are basically allowing you to do a lot of interesting things on that second display. So it's basically like a control knob for whatever you do, whether you're in the camera or in games or something. It's going to be that, like, just place where LG can dump all of its additional controls and not muck up the first screen. And if they do that okay, the way that they did it with the dual screen accessory on the V60 and the Velvet and all those, I think it'll actually be quite a good experience. But Russell, I don't think you're as confident.
I mean, it's weird. It's funny. We just got done talking about a whole bunch of these folding phones, and one of the things that got brought up very early on was the kind of durability and survivability of that new kind of folding experience. I think I'm actually more concerned about the longevity of the folding mechanism, the kind of sliding mechanism for this. And the only reason that I say that is that this is actually not the first time that LG has made this phone. There was a basic service phone that came out, gosh, I guess it was probably 11, maybe 12 years ago now, that flipped out like this and gave you a kind of a widescreen display when you wanted it, that you could like watch videos and stuff on. And it got made popular, actually, I think, by Iron Man 2. Because Tony Stark was the one who was using it, and it was like a whole big thing. Even though like his version was obviously like Jarvis on board and stuff, but a lot of people who had that phone, like, it fell to pieces a lot because the hinge mechanism on it just wasn't very good, and at some points it even stopped locking into place when you would fold the phone back down. So I'm a little concerned about its ability to survive a drop or two and still be able to do the main thing that it does. I'm less concerned about it kind of breaking in the same way that we think about folding phones breaking when they get dropped or wet. But yeah, it's a cool thing that I would want to try out, and I dig the camera aspect on it if it works, but it just doesn't seem like so many other things from LG recently. It really just doesn't seem like a complete thought.
Here's an idea though. I think the wing with its square display underneath, I think it'd be a really fun like Game Boy emulator.
Yeah, I think that'd be cool.
I think so many of these conversations about folding phones end up as, which is going to be the best DS emulator? And the answer is always the one that most resembles a DS, which is the Duo. Like,
yep.
If you look at the Duo, it just has two distinct screens, and unfortunately you can't really do anything with that, but I think that eventually the Duo is going to be a killer emulator, and I cannot wait for it.
Guys, a DSi is like $80 on eBay.
I know, but
it's true.
Still.
And there are accessories for it, unlike the Surface Duo.
Fair. Also, I'm looking at this LG VX9400, the proto wing.
Yeah.
Which is kind of amazing. I'd never, this was before my time, so I didn't know that they commercialized this.
Yeah, this is real old school. And then like nobody was going to buy the phone, and then it showed up in Iron Man 2, I think. And then they just flew off the shelves for a little while because every nerd wanted to have Tony Stark's phone. And then they realized that it wasn't actually a smartphone. It was just as quickly as it got popular, it got unpopular because it wasn't Jarvis. So nobody wanted it.
Of course. No, this is way before, this is like 3 years before Siri was even
In very much the same way that the Matrix phone flew off the shelves because Neo had a Matrix phone and then they realized it was actually way less functional than most of the other phones in its generation. Like, we fell for that a lot in that particular span of years.
So this is really interesting. Wikipedia says that it was a Verizon exclusive, CDMA only, and it was one of the first two phones on the market to support live mobile TV broadcasts.
Yep.
Using Qualcomm's MediaFlow technology, which obviously never really caught on in North America.
And outside of the U.S., there was a Korean version of the phone that had just a straight-up no-TV antenna that slid out of the back of it.
Incredible. Also, speaking of Sasha Segan, he was one of the three people cited on Wikipedia to actually do this thing.
Of course he was. I love Sasha.
Oh, man. Okay, so... let's take a break and we will come back and talk about, we don't really know when the wing is going to be, available. So we don't know price. We don't really know availability. We think it's towards the end of this month, but we can say now on the record that it is coming and, we're recording this before we know a lot about it, but after we're allowed to talk about it publicly, if that makes any sense, because LG likes to trickle out information about pricing and availability. So we know that it's coming to the U.S. That's basically all we know, and we will follow up probably next week when we know more about the phone itself. All right, let's take a break, and we will come back and talk about some video games. This episode of the Android Central Podcast is brought to you by SanDisk. We've all experienced the problem of running out of storage space on our phones, and that's why we've been talking about SanDisk, the global leader in data storage solutions that has you covered no matter what smartphone you have. I move files all the time. I have photos. I have documents that I share up in Google Drive. I have just a myriad of things that are in different places. I have Dropbox, and they're all messy. But one thing that isn't messy is my SanDisk Ultra Dual Drive Lux USB Type-C flash drive. It's a game changer when it comes to transferring important files between devices, including a USB Type-C smartphone, a tablet, a Mac, or a USB Type-A computer. All you need to do is install the SanDisk Memory Zone app on your Android phone and select whatever files you want to back up, and then seamlessly move photos, videos, music, documents, or contacts off of your device, freeing up valuable space. And once those files are on the SanDisk Ultra Dual Drive Lux, which is super fast at 150 megabytes per second, you can get transferring even more stuff quicker thanks to up to 1 terabyte of storage. This disk drive goes all the way from 32 gigs up to 1 terabyte of storage, so you will never run out of space. Plus, SanDisk makes other great products for both Android and Apple devices, like the Extreme Micro SD UHS 1 card, and the iXpand Flash Drive Go. So take our advice. Free up space on your phone with SanDisk today. Right now, you can get 10% off your first order of these SanDisk products, but only when you go to sandisk.com/ACP. You have to go to sandisk.com/ACP for 10% off your first order. Russell.
Yo.
How are you feeling?
It's been good.
Are you bored of talking about phones yet?
No, I'm never bored of talking about phones, but...
Oh, good. Oh, good. I'm glad. But I do want to talk to you about video games because this week was just a torrent of Xbox news, and we're not a video game podcast. We have Jiggle Physics for that, which celebrated its 50th episode.
Yeah.
Absolutely go listen to it. It's amazing. But... if you're listening to this one, at least we can inform you of some cool Xbox things. And I promise we'll bring it back to mobile in a little bit. So this week, Microsoft unveiled the price of the Xbox Series S, the Series X, the release date, the pre-order dates. Walk us through all those before we get into the nitty-gritty.
Yeah, so Microsoft's in a reaction to some leaked information very late on Monday, where most of the U.S. was on holiday, Tuesday at 3 o'clock in the morning Eastern time just dropped a social media post that confirmed that the Xbox Series S did in fact exist and was going to be $299, which is cheaper than you can get a nice Xbox One X right now. So that made a lot of people very happy. It also doesn't have a disc drive, which is similar to the Xbox One All Digital Edition that is available right now. But it's the less capable of the two consoles that are coming out this year. So we're kind of getting a pixel strategy from Microsoft and from Sony this year, and that we're getting kind of a smaller, slightly less capable, less expensive version of the thing, and then the much bigger, more capable version of the thing at the same time. Whereas historically, like, Microsoft and Sony would kind of leapfrog one over the other over the next couple of years. They've kind of realized that there's just, like, those battle lines are drawn. There are people who want the cheap one, and there are people who want the not cheap one, and so they're going to give them to them at the same time. But I think the coolest thing about the pricing here is that it comes with at least 1 year, regardless of which console you go with, of Xbox Game Pass Ultimate.
Okay, so talk us through what that means.
So Xbox Game Pass is kind of fascinating because it kind of means three different things. If you are, like, there's Xbox Game Pass for the PC, which is the ability to play like a Netflix-style library of games that are only available on PC, and a couple of console games that have made their way to PC. For a set price. And there is Xbox Game Pass for the Xbox, which is a massive, like, I think it's 180 now catalog of games that you can play without, paying per game. You're paying that, like, Netflix style subscription for access to these games. And Microsoft tosses in brand new games all the time. Like, the new Halo game that's coming out, the very first thing they did was say, by the way, this is going to be on Game Pass day one. So, like, a lot of the games that are made by Microsoft Game Studios, if you have an Xbox and you pay for the subscription, you just immediately have it. You don't have to pay the extra $70 for it or anything. It's just already there, which is cool. There's a third version of Xbox Game Pass, which a lot of people previously knew as Project xCloud, which is the ability to stream games to things that are not an Xbox. And so that includes streaming to an Android phone. Among other places, being able to stream them to a PC and things like that are also being talked about. But the big thing there was being able to stream to your Android phone the entire Xbox game experience. And if you've ever tried xCloud, you know that it works reasonably well as long as you've got a decent internet connection and you're kind of seated somewhere with a nice controller. You can play, just again, you will have access to hundreds of Xbox games of incredible quality. They haven't really been optimized for the phone. If text shows up small on, your big 55-inch television, then you can imagine what it's going to look like on your 7.5-inch phone. But it's there. You can play these games, in the exact same version. It's not a streamed down mobile version. It's the same version streamed from an Xbox, and it's really cool.
Okay, so the way that I heard it described in basic terms to, like, non-hardcore gamers like me is the Xbox Series X is for people with a 4K TV who want to play in 4K, and the Series S is for people who want to play at 1440p, who basically have a 1080p television and are satisfied with that resolution. But the games themselves, regardless of resolution or outside of the resolution, should look pretty much the same, and that both systems have essentially the same CPU-GPU combo, just that the one on the S Series X is clocked down quite a bit, especially on the GPU side.
That's right. So yeah, they're essentially very similar hardware inside of these consoles, but one is set to run noticeably lower than the other, which allows for thermals to be kind of different, which is important because the Xbox One X, or I'm sorry, the Xbox Series X looks like a refrigerator, and the Xbox Series S is actually smaller and thinner than the Xbox One X that came out, the Project Scorpio edition, that was all kind of sleek and thin looking. This version is actually smaller than that, and will look much nicer on an entertainment center. Although there's been some weird pushback. It's this two-tone plastic where it's, like, all white around, and then the one of the air vents is this, like, black disc. And there are a bunch of people weirdly critical of that that white on black thing. I think it looks fine, but it's so you get this much smaller, you know, kind of sleeker system that you know will work well on any television, but isn't really designed super well for 4K televisions. Or the thing that is like the, you know, the top of the line will continue to play things at 4K 60 for quite a while.
Right. Okay. So then there's the Xbox All Access system, which or program, which is basically you pay one monthly fee and you get the Xbox of your choice, either Series X or Series S, plus Game Pass Ultimate included in a 2-year contract.
Right.
And this is, as far as I know, it's already available in the US, but it's expanding to other markets, and they're going to include it with the new consoles later this year.
Yeah, so this is something that they started with this past Xbox, and they're rolling it out to this in more areas, and they're including Game Pass with it to really kind of round it all out. And what that basically means is if you want the Series S and you want to pay for it over time and you know that you're going to want Game Pass, you pay $24 a month over 2 years. And if you want the Series X, you pay $34 a month over 2 years. And if you do that math, it's really kind of insane how inexpensive that is and what it means Microsoft is sacrificing as far as how much money it would normally make. If you were already paying for Game Pass, like if you'd already decided that Game Pass was something that you wanted, which I think a lot of people already do, then if you're already paying for that and you want to get a Series S, you essentially over 2 years are only paying $240 for a $300 console over 2 years. And the same goes for the $500 Series X. You pay $460 for a $540 console, which is that's a sign of how badly Microsoft just wants people on that monthly subscription for things like Xbox Live and for Game Pass. The math there is just insane from a hardware perspective, because Microsoft already knows that the way that it makes money is through accessories and you know through subscriptions. So it's really just deciding that it's never going to make money off of the core console ever again.
And I think this has been the way it's been going for a while now, right? Microsoft has leaned into subscriptions in a way that Sony hasn't. Right?
Right,
and it's very much, it seems like the future, regardless of what console you're on. Stadia, Google went in on subscriptions from day one. That is what Stadia is. You don't have a hardware, a console to buy. And Sony has obviously it has PlayStation Now. It's got this, you know, PS Plus that I'm sure it will bolster with the PlayStation 5. But what I'm really curious about is this sort of, when you say all access, like it's, I want to sort of reframe all access as like you have access to whatever Microsoft has given you within Game Pass, basically anywhere. And we can talk about iOS not supporting xCloud and why that is. I mean, it's, if you've been following the Epic Games controversy, you know why. But I just want to talk about like Microsoft's goal here is to make games available on any screen you want.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter whether you have hardware anymore or not. At least that's the intention. So talk about how that plays into the company's kind of future goal for the Xbox as a service.
Yeah, I mean, that's the deal, right? Like is having people being able to play, you know, the rhetoric is anywhere they are. And this goes way deeper than just like being able to stream it to a phone. Last year, Microsoft rolled out a set of special controller APIs for developers to build, you know, kind of special button maps for people who wanted to play on a phone but only use the glass and not use a controller on either side of it, like we've seen with some of the ones that Razer and other companies have come out with. And the long-term goal from Microsoft's perspective is to encourage a set of gamers who are phone first. Like they're going to use the phone most of the time, and if they have an Xbox, then they'll use it when they sit down. Or in the case of Samsung users, you know, grab a controller and plug it into their television and play xCloud through DeX, which Microsoft has already recognized as a thing people are going to do. So it's really, you know, I think they've they've understood that the mobile ecosystem is where the most gamers are, and this is the best way to reach them. And if you can get someone to only have an Android phone but still pay for a Game Pass subscription, then Microsoft has already won. Like, that's all they really need, because they've already seen, you know, there are a lot of developers who make more money through Game Pass than they would have by just releasing the game into the Microsoft Store, which is, you know, that this model is clearly working not just for Microsoft, but for the developers supporting it as well.
Right. So there's a lot to unpack there, and I want to bring this back to mobile in a second, but you're saying that, you know, developers get a share of the revenue, right? Obviously, that's part of the incentive of adding a game to one of these subscriptions. That's why Apple Arcade exists. There's also Google's Play Pass, which is bad objectively, but it has the same intention, right? That developers get a cut of whatever apps are being used in there, and they get a share of the revenue. It means that they don't really have to charge for premium games up front, which we know don't really do that well on mobile. I'm wondering, you know, with the rise of Android is becoming this really interesting platform for games, because you can play the myriad Android games. And increasingly we have this diversity of, like, here's a crappy free-to-play game that you can use with one hand and you don't really have to concentrate on. There's millions of those, or I guess hundreds of thousands. There are a lot of really good premium mobile first games that are launched on Android and iOS still, and they do fairly well. Then there are the console ports, you know, the GTA series that has always done really well, the Minecraft that has done really well on Android. These are ports of existing console games brought over to Android. And then there's this added element now where you have Stadia and xCloud that are bringing tier one console first and sometimes console only games that are not necessarily optimized for smaller displays, but with a little bit of work and an added controller, play pretty well. And I'm wondering how you think this will change the dynamic of game development, knowing that publishers and developers can build for mobile experiences that it may not be the intention, it may not be the primary screen, but it'll certainly be a screen that people can play on. And do you think that will affect the way that games are designed when they have so many screen sizes that they need to optimize for?
It's really hard to tell, you know, how so far developers haven't made any amount of effort to specifically target smaller screens when they release something to Game Pass. And I get that xCloud is relatively new, but even, you know, some of the games built over the last couple of months, you know, the target for mobile is, you know, it's great that you're here, not, hey, let's make something that works for you. And I'm really curious when that transition point is going to be, because if Game Pass, you know, on Android continues in this trajectory of popularity, then that, you know, that could very well change. And Microsoft has already included those tools to make it possible. But we're going to start seeing things like, you know, text needs to be in different sizes in order to support, you know, a bunch of different kinds of screen sizes. And some of that is done automatically on xCloud's end, where xCloud can target, you know, okay, this is the kind of screen that we're streaming to right now. But right now there is no real developer support for smaller screens, and that change is probably, I would say, probably about a year away.
All right, so let's talk a bit about Stadia. We're almost a year out from the Stadia launch. It did not go well for the first couple of months. You reviewed it when it came out in November 2019. It was just not a great service. Our coworker, Jen Locke, she re-reviewed it a few months later. Still at the time was not a great service, but we now have a fairly robust category of games. They seem to be getting most of the AAA games that are coming to Xbox and PlayStation on day one. We have Baldur's Gate 3 hitting later this month. We have a bunch of the new Ubisoft games that were announced yesterday as we're recording this that are coming on day one to Stadia. In fact, one of the games I think has an exclusive demo on Stadia that is a timed demo. So talk about what's happening in Stadia and how it's changed over the last year and potentially, kind of countered a lot of those first negative criticisms.
Yeah, the Stadia team has been working super hard to get new features out there to work with as many different things as possible, and at the same time release compelling games that people are already interested in playing. So it's this kind of two-pronged approach. The first is demonstrate a level of multiplayer gameplay that can only really be done through Stadia. And they're trying that through things like Super Bomberman R, where they can have, 150 people play in a match together. And you can kind of jump in and see things from other players' perspectives as you go and play. And it's this kind of unique experience to Stadia, but at the same time, making sure that these AAA games are getting day one or even earlier access. Marvel's Avengers was available 72 hours earlier on Stadia than anywhere else. So like if you absolutely had to play it as soon as physically possible, you could immediately play it on Stadia. And the advantage that the Stadia team is not shy about hammering home anytime that it gets the ability to is that there's no install time. There's no update time. There's no, when a DLC comes out for something, it's just immediately available. There's no, 50 gig patch for a game when it comes out, for an update on Stadia. There is no, day one patch that you have to wait for after you've pre-installed it. Like these are advantages that kind of continue to push away at the people who are regularly frustrated by the console experience. But the conversion rate is still not super high. That we're not seeing, the deal with Ubisoft, it's great to see that Ubisoft has not abandoned Stadia, but Ubisoft was the original test subject with Stadia, with Assassin's Creed back when it was being tested 2 years ago. And Ubisoft has maintained that relationship, but we haven't seen a lot of adoption from other studios yet. So the progress is steady. But the conversion rate for Stadia is still not tremendously high. There are just not a lot of people willing to jump ship yet.
I mean, that's interesting you say that jump ship, because it seems like Stadia is being positioned that as a direct competitor to Xbox and PlayStation. And I wonder if that is the case, or at least that will be the case long term. Obviously, Stadia is a subscription, right? So it's $10 a month and you can get access to a whole bunch of discounts, but also every month there are a bunch of free games. And once, as long as you're a subscriber, you can keep those games. I have let my subscription lapse. So once I, pick up Stadia again and I subscribe to Stadia Pro, I can keep all those games again or get them back. But I wonder if you think that it's a problem really with messaging, right? Do people not know what Stadia is? Is it a direct competitor to Xbox and PlayStation, or is it something else entirely?
Yeah, I think it has to be seen. Out of the gate, it was very much presented as a competitor to the traditional console market. It was the alternative to all of the mess behind owning a console and waiting for install times and things like that. The big thing was, this is how much GPU power we have now. Even if you upgrade to the next generation console, you have access to, 14 teraflops of power or something. Well, on Stadia, we can just flip a switch in 6 months and then we'll have 20 teraflops of power. So like there's no new hardware to buy. There's no, the subscription is the only thing that really matters there. And that, I think that they're trying to target very specific groups of people when, the immediate features that caught people's attention was the ability to kind of push a game and immediately start playing. And that's only going to matter once some of the YouTube features that they talked about are up and running. So like the big thing there is having someone on YouTube, a celebrity of some kind playing a game and having someone say, oh, like this is the first time they played this game. I really want to play this game too, and be able to just click a single button and immediately have that game and start playing. Like that's kind of the long-term vision for Stadia, and they're still not 100% of the way there.
The last thing I want to talk about is just performance. Has Stadia improved over the last year or so? Have there been noticeable drops or lessening of lag? And is this a console-like experience the way that you would get it on a PlayStation 4 Pro or an Xbox One X right now? How much work does Google still need to do to get to that level, especially with the new console generations looming? And we're going to have 4K 60 on both of the new platforms. Can Stadia actually compete, even though they claim to have 14 teraflops, which is technically more powerful than both next gen consoles?
Yeah, so I mean, it's the way that this comes down is the heavy lifting of making Stadia a console is there and works well. I can sit down at my couch, I can pick up my controller, I can push a button, and the TV turns on, the Stadia logo shows up, and I can start playing a game, and that part is great. The social features don't compare to what either Microsoft or Sony currently have to offer. It's still very difficult to play a game and share something cool that happened in that game to social media. You know, if I have something cool that I found and I want to take a screenshot and share that screenshot somewhere, it's still really not easy to do within the Stadia platform. And to say less, the ability to record a video really quickly and share that, those are still pretty significant challenges. And you know, there just straight up aren't enough people on Stadia for me to like jump into a video chat or an audio chat with while I'm playing a game. So the social aspect of gaming is still pretty significantly lagging. But the actual sitting down and playing a game, yeah, it feels exactly like a console.
So we're getting there. I'm really excited to see what Google does, because they're going to have to step up in some way once PS5 and Xbox Series X are available later this year. It's going to be super interesting. Hiato, I want to bring you into this for a minute before we take a break. What are you most excited about when it comes to console gaming over the next few months?
I mean, I am very interested in the whole streaming thing. Like I used PlayStation Now a couple of years ago. It was still pretty early, but I used it before they kind of remastered BioShock and brought it to the newer consoles so that I could still play it on my PS4. And it worked pretty well back then. It was maybe not a perfect experience, but you know, that was 3-4 years ago. These days, I haven't messed with anything like it since. And I haven't messed with Stadia at all. So I am interested in that stuff, and I want to see like how it works with Microsoft's system as well. I don't know. I don't really know what I'm going to be doing as far as like new consoles go. I don't know if I'm going to buy the Xbox Series S or X, especially like with these financing deals. It's very, very tempting considering all you get with it. But I also don't play games necessarily enough to really want to spend $400 or $500 on something. Honestly, the only thing I'm really looking forward to that I just have to have is coming out next week, which is just Spelunky 2. I've spent so much time on Spelunky 1, and I just need that. And that's luckily coming to PS4, so I don't need an next-gen console for that. But eventually, you know, there'll come some reason for me to get something new. And I don't know, maybe I'll look into Stadia instead of spending a bunch of money.
Is Spelunky 2 coming to Stadia? I don't even know.
I don't think so. I think it's just PlayStation exclusive.
Not yet. Okay. All right, maybe then. All right, well, I really enjoyed that conversation. I don't get to talk a lot about video games, so I appreciate your insight, Russell, on that. We're going to take a quick break and come back with what's making us happy. Stay tuned. This episode of the Android Central podcast is brought to you by Indeed. One of the greatest challenges we all face is taking all the information that's available and knowing where to focus. It's that same problem we run into with hiring, too. But with Indeed, you have access to the largest pool of talent and can hire the right people fast. Indeed.com is the number one job site in the world because Indeed gets you the best people fast. Unlike other sites, Indeed gives you full control and payment flexibility over your hiring. You pay only for what you need. You can pause your account at any time, and there are no long-term contracts. Plus, Indeed provides powerful tools to make your search that much easier, like sponsored jobs, which are known to be 3.5 times more likely to result in a hire. With 73% of online job seekers visiting Indeed each month, Indeed is going to get you the important hire you need, just like they have for over 3 million businesses. Right now, Indeed is offering our listeners a free $75 credit to boost your job post, which means more quality candidates will see it fast. Try Indeed out with a free $75 credit at indeed.com/ACP. This is their best offer anywhere. Go right now to indeed.com/ACP. Terms and conditions apply. Offer valid through September 30th. Mm-hmm. All right. So to end out today's show, as we do every week, we are going to say something that is making us happy. It doesn't have to be tech related at all. It can be, I don't know, it can be a nice breeze. It can be a smell, the wafting smell of coffee as you walk downstairs in the morning. Actually, that should be mine this week, but I just said it. So we're going to start with you, Hayato. What's making you happy this week?
A nice breeze and a waft of coffee is exactly what's making me happy.
Oh,
my,
no.
My answer in the rundown spreadsheet was actually just the cooler weather that's slowly making its way over here. It's still kind of hot over here in Indy, but it's getting there. You know, it's not 95 every day like it has been for the last couple of months. I just ordered a bunch of stuff from Uniqlo for like sort of like fall attire, and it hasn't shipped yet, but I'm very excited to just have some just comfortable clothing again, not like, you know, t-shirts that I wear knowing that I'm gonna sweat in them and have to just change halfway through the day. I'm really looking forward to just being comfortable outside, just being able to walk around, and it's not too cold because I just can't stand the winter, but I'm also kind of getting to that point where I don't love the summer anymore, and fall is kind of optimal for me. So we're getting there. That's making me happy for sure.
Yeah, I feel that too. It's been a little too cold here this week. I think I'm a few degrees below where you are, but I'll take it. I'll take a nice sweater day. It feels good for the first little while, and then it gets too much, and then I want summer back.
Yeah. All I want right now is to be able to wear a sweater or just something over my arms.
Yeah, yeah, I understand that. Although you have such a beautiful tattoo sleeve, why would you want to cover that up?
I do that thing where I just roll it up like halfway at my forearm.
I can't stand you right now.
It's really just same. From the elbow up. He just wants from the elbow up to be warm.
Of course. All right, Russell, what's making you happy this week?
I just finished watching Class Action Park, which is a documentary that's on HBO Max. And if you haven't taken the time to watch it, you should. The reason that it makes me happy is because we are not those people anymore as a culture. Class Action Park, for those who are unaware, is a park. It is a park called Action Park that happened in New Jersey in the 80s, and it is just like all of your worst nightmares about a theme park all come together, where just like some guy high on his own supply just thought he was going to make water park rides out of like PVC pipe and hopes and prayers, and then was surprised when people got hurt. And yeah, it made me really happy to get to the end of that and be like, we are better than that now, and that's cool.
Yeah, I've been reading about this. What a shit show.
It is an impressive, like, watching the documentary, I kept thinking like, oh, there's going to be a point where like, this is the worst thing they've done. And no, like right up until literally the last minute, you're just like, wow, that's holy crap.
Yeah. I got to watch this. It sounds like just a disaster.
It's great because we're not those people anymore. And that makes me, I'm happy.
Well, yeah. I mean, there's other things going on, but at least we're not murdering children on water slides anymore. So that's that's a bonus. Well, cool. Yeah, I plan to watch that. All right. What's making me happy this week, because I just did this Surface Duo video and I tried to make my background not just a white wall, I tried to set up some hue lights and colors and stuff. And it just made me really appreciative of the Nano Leaf. They're called
shapes,
Nanoleaf shapes hexagons, and they are amazing. And I just got a box of them that I'm installing. I have the triangle version that had been on my wall for like 2 years now. My daughter, who's 2 years old, just absolutely loves whenever I turn them on and they change colors. I know, Russell, you obviously have a couple of these set up in your place. They are just so much fun to mess around with and to install and to get creative. They're a Toronto-based company, so I'm proud of that. And they're not cheap, but honestly, they're kind of like they're the first art lighting, like smart lighting. They just you can make art out of them. And if you go to their website, I think it's nanoleaf.io or something like that. Just look up Nanoleaf on Google. They are nanoleaf.me. You can see exactly what I'm talking about. You can set these up in any orientation to suit your room, and they're just cool as hell.
Well, and they're also weirdly kid friendly. Like, you have not known joy until you set lights up like this and then encourage a small child to touch one of the panels and have it change color when they touch them. Or like set up one of the ripple things where they touch one panel and the colors ripple out when they've touched one of the panels. Like, that is joy in a way that a lot of people don't adequately experience, because it just feels like magic.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, I'm excited. I haven't set these ones up yet. I still have the older non-touch version of the triangles, so I'm very excited about that. The original light panels. So yeah, shout out Nanoleaf. They are making really good products.
You know, you brought up your A-roll setup. Can we talk for a second about like your little knickknacks revolving around you? Like,
yeah, of course. The bobblehead you have. I keep a shrine to myself on my on my mantle. Who doesn't? I have a snapback with my name on it. That was given to me by Motorola back in 2018 when we did a trip to Chicago. I think it was for the Moto Z3 or Z4.
Three, I think, yeah.
And I also have one of those 3D printed renders of myself from a Raptors game where GoDaddy sponsored it. So they basically had you stand in this little light box and a camera goes around you 360, creates a 360 degree image. And then they printed a version of myself and gave it to me. It was really weird. So I've held on to that for like 5 years now, and I love it. It's just this little reminder that I'm an insignificant person in the universe.
That's amazing.
It's very introspective. No, actually, I'm surprised it's lasted, because my daughter has stolen it a couple of times and run away with it going, "I'm holding daddy, I'm holding daddy." It's really weird. All right. Well, that's a lot of good stuff. Thank you for making me happier this week, guys. Thanks for joining us. It's a pleasure having you, Russell.
Yeah, this is great.
We'll have you back soon. And Hayato, you're the son I never knew I wanted. So thanks again for, you know, being so great.
Thanks, Dad.
You can find Russell at Russell Hawley. You can find Hayato at Hayato Huseman. You can find me at Journey Dan. You can find all of us at Android Central. And if you haven't already listened to this week's episode of Jiggle Physics, it is amazing. All right, that's it. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.